Welcome, this is With All Due Respect by Eternity. I'm Megan Paldetoir and I'm here with my co-host Michael Jensen.
Hi, here I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Exactly, so I'm not lying.
No.
And we're talking about sin. There's a bit of a frisson when you say that. It's sort of a bit tantalising. We're going to talk about sin this episode.
Ooh.
Yes. Is it a sin to talk about sin? And we're going to answer some questions that people gave us about sin.
Yeah.
Some listeners. And then we are going to be listening to some Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah, it's a real challenge.
For both of us. So stay with us.
For argument's sake, where we take a debate, cut out the party politics and try to talk it out. And we're going to talk about sin. And we've got a number of things to talk about with sin. It's a big topic, but we want to talk about what sin is and what effect it has on human beings. I guess one of the things with sin as the Bible describes it is it doesn't just narrow it down to one thing. It talks about it as law-breaking. It talks about it as falling short or trespassing.
What's interesting, isn't it?
Impurity and unholiness.
Because when I was saying I was going to be talking about this, people were saying, oh, yes, we don't like the word sin anymore. But actually, that's the English word. And
yes,
that translates a whole lot of different Hebrew and Greek words. So it's interesting how hung up we get up on that particular English
word. I've decided in my preaching to use the word sin again because I stopped using it because it has a kind of cultural jarringness to it because sin is now associated with chocolate or indulgence in food, interestingly, or, you know, there was actually, I think, a line of ice creams called the Seven Deadly Sins.
They're very nice.
And then also it's sort of been seen as a therapeutic problem. So sin is actually we need to actually seek therapy for sin, not a moral problem anymore. So it sounds,
which is not completely that's not completely outside of the biblical understanding of sin, but it's just one aspect of it. Would you?
Yeah,
agree?
I want to say the word sin has a particular spiritual force, and so when I say sin, I almost want that jarring nature. I don't want to just say we're broken. I want to say we're culpably broken.
Although one of the words for sin in the Bible does bring up that whole broken idea.
Yeah, which one's that?
Yeah, that'd be my Hebrew knowledge. I didn't want to say. But there is one that talks about that and the idea of having gone off and so on, that something's no longer of use.
I have no excuse because I studied Hebrew for 3 years and I can't remember which one it is. But sin, both makes us both the victim and the perpetrator at once, and I want to not just see us as victims in the language we use. Although I definitely want to say that we are sort of victims of sin. It affects us. We pass it on to one another. It's both social and individual.
I also use the word sin in my preaching and so on, and get pulled up on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's not particularly, like in some of the tribes I inhabit, it's not a popular word. But I actually like it because I find the word sin is one where my evangelicalism and my feminism really intersects.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So how are they, these strange bedfellows? How do they work together on this?
In your mind, they're strange bedfellows.
Well, people do think of them. So explain how they intersect.
Well, because I think what feminism is saying is that there are things that are wrong. And it doesn't want to disconnect people's behaviour from their philosophies of life and so on. So it actually wants to name things and say, we need to do better about this. That there is a sort of a facing up to evil, in a way. And I think evangelicalism also has that it doesn't shy away from injustice and evil and so on and calling that out. So there is that I think in some other philosophies that don't want to really face up to things. So I would, if I could use that in my feminism, I would say this is sinful. I think we should. And sometimes I feel like the reaction that people have when we call out some misogyny and so on, it's because they are uncomfortable with being called out on their sin.
Yeah, and I would say some of the great moralizers of our day are, in fact, coming from a feminist perspective, and they should own the fact that they're moralizers. It's interesting they don't like being called moralizers, but that's what they're doing. They're calling out evil as they see it. I guess I wonder whether feminism is a diagnosis of sin and evil in terms in one term. It's seeing
yes, which is quite a pervasive. aspect of society and our lives, but yes.
Yeah, obviously, but it would be like Marxism would say sin comes through the alienation of people from its labour. It's got a kind of different diagnosis. And I guess I'd want to say the biblical view is both social and systemic. It names that, but it also talks about individual sin.
Well, and I think that there is still that within feminism that says the individuals make their own choices, that we need to have responsibility for, we need to take responsibility rather than just sort of, you know, saying, oh, well, we're all sort of subject to culture. I actually think that some of the way that the Me Too story has been responded to is that saying, let's take individual responsibility.
I hope so. I mean, I'm not hearing that vibe. I'm hearing more sort of like there's a corrupt system rather than, and it's out there rather than in my heart. So that's where, I certainly think that a problem with particularly men's behaviour towards women is to do with men's hearts, individual hearts, is to do with my heart, not just the system.
The two things interconnect.
Of power.
And maybe that's for me, I find like a good synergy between, because I would think of myself as an evangelical feminist, the two things for me really sort of enrich each other.
Enrich, like the individual and the...
Yes, so I definitely see both, like as you're saying, individual and social sin are both important and they need to be taken account of.
And I want to say too, what the Bible helps me to see is how I'm not just the victim but I'm the perpetrator as well, so that I'm not, by being a victim, innocent. It's not being a victim doesn't just convey moral innocence on me.
Although, also in the Bible, there is a lot of a sense of that God is on the side of the vulnerable, of those who have been put into a place where it is much more difficult for them to find a way out. So that there's a recognition of the way that. That how we're shaped changes the sin that we're guilty of from societal forces. Do you see what I'm saying?
The sin that we're guilty of, it shapes the sin we're guilty of, although it doesn't make us innocent. I've been looking at Exodus recently. It's interesting how the oppressed people, the people of Israel, then go out into the wilderness and become then culpable. They become then responsible, and they're given agency. They're given their liberty, but then all of a sudden they're guilty of doing some of the same things that the Egyptians were doing.
So bringing up agency and liberty, can we go into one of our key differences?
Well, I think, absolutely. I mean, I think I would definitely want to say that the impact of sin on the human condition actually makes it impossible for us not to sin, that we are, as Calvinists would say, totally depraved, in the sense that they don't mean by that we're demonic. What we mean by that is that every aspect, including our will, is tainted by sin. So that in Ephesians, Paul says, you are dead in your sins. Not sick, but dead. And so unable to...
So can I give a bit of a church history lesson here?
Oh, for sure.
As I like to do. So for those who aren't theology nerds like myself and Michael, if you want to know what Calvinism and Arminianism is, this is like a short, brief version.
Calvinism, approved by both.
Yes, we did approve it. Calvinism is based on the thought of John Calvin, and it really emphasises God's sovereignty. And Arminianism is based on the thought of Arminius, and it has more to say about free will. And if you want to know a lot more about that, we'll put a link in the show notes to show you some other places to read. So people misunderstand often that Arminianism, I would describe myself as a particular kind of Arminian, they see it as opposed to Calvinism, but actually total depravity is the thing that they're not opposed on.
Uh-huh.
So the 5 points of Calvinism, Tulip, actually come after the 5 articles of remonstrance of Arminianism, and one of those was total depravity.
Yes, but how would you, in terms of Arminians, classically have a different understanding of the freedom of the will? Is this correct?
Yes, but we do think that what we think is that God's grace is needed because people are sinful to bring them to faith. We call it prevenient grace. It's just that we think that can be resisted.
Grace can be resisted.
Yes. So God has to work on you for you to be able to accept him, but that work that God's doing is not irresistible.
Not irresistible, as in it's not a sense in which you can you are free to choose. It's free to choose God for God, but you are free to choose against him.
Yeah, so it's not that God hasn't been part of that process of decision or hasn't had to work through his grace, but in his grace, God doesn't overwhelm you with his grace.
So how do you understand deadness in sins then?
Well, you say you still need God, but once he has given that grace...
This prevenient grace, though, comes in what form? So I've heard that explained as if it comes through creation itself. You know, it's something prior to the gospel itself.
I would, getting into personal ideas, understandings of it, I think God is continually at work in the world and continually at work with people. God's really personal. I have a lot of experiences that show that God was working in friends' lives when they came to Christ. So I think it's an incredibly personal process of God working with us. It's not just creation. But I'm just saying that process doesn't overwhelm you.
That process doesn't overwhelm...
Like, it doesn't force you to a particular decision.
No, and I don't think anyone would say it forces you to a particular decision. I don't think that's the traditional Calvinist position. It doesn't take away human agency, just like
Except
Pharaoh's.
I would say you do take away human agency because you say it can't be resisted.
Well, Pharaoh's,
so I think it's nonsense. Sorry,
Pharaoh's heart is both hardened and he is self hardening at the same time. So throughout Exodus, he kind of hardens his heart, and also God hardens his heart, and neither that those are somehow not contradictory.
Yes, but also you can't... I wasn't trying to be rude there with the word nonsense. I mean, nonsense in that... Just, you're saying something semantic, but it actually doesn't work. That's how I can't come at it. It doesn't work for me in that once you're saying that God is completely in control of that, I can't see any agency remaining.
Because we don't have any agency in the first place. I guess
So how can you hold people responsible for their sins?
Well, that's where original sin comes in, and where we say actually, both collectively and individually, we are responsible. Or in Adam, we die. It's in our Adamic condition we would die.
That still for me is unjust.
Well, you're not God. That's the thing. Yeah, of course.
No,
of course,
but God is unjust.
But we're not condemned for someone else. In one level, we are in Adam, but culpably in Adam. So one version of that would be to say that Adam is our representative, and so he does what he goes where we would have gone. So there is a sense in which we belong in him. The other way of saying that is we are always then sin prone, and so we are always then going to sin. We're held responsible for our actual sins, but it's because of our Adamic nature that we...
Yeah, that we so, so I mean, I'm not convinced that Calvinism is either just or fits in with the biblical descriptions of agency and free will.
The second is more important.
But can we come back to total depravity, since we both are saying we agree with that?
Yeah. Surprised.
Go
on. I've talked to Arminians who deny it utterly.
Yes, so. but historically it was an Arminian position. It's not to say some people might not now. But I would see that as, it's not that there's nothing good about you, but that sin has a pervasive effect.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I'd say every faculty. So what's important for us to say, for instance, is that it's not as if our reason is uncorrupted and our emotions are corrupt. Both are corrupted, or both are part of our fallenness. And likewise, individually and socially, we can't kind of just say, well, society is good, but the individual is bad, or the individual is good and the society is bad. I think that kind of the pervasive... And I would also say that deadness in our sins is quite crucial to me, because otherwise grace doesn't operate. It's not that I kind of have a spark of goodness in me that somehow is warmed when I see and my will chooses. I've got this kind of free will which enables me to choose the gospel when I see it.
But there's still, within people who do not have the gospel, there's still goodness.
There is, because Paul says so.
That's right. So, I mean, for me, that's where it sits, is that sin has... It's like going back to Julius Sumner Miller and how the liquid gets into the chalk, if you remember that really old
yes,
ad.
Yes.
It just goes through the entire thing, that, which is why it's when we're talking about systemic things, because systems are made up of individuals, and so the consequences of sin just go on a system-wide basis. Like, the whole thing is gets stuffed up.
They do, and it's remarkable that human beings do what they do, and that God has preserved us in the way he has, and that we don't fall apart more than we do. I mean, and we would say, I don't know if you use the term common grace, but I would say that there's a sort of a common grace by which the world is kept from falling into sludge. You know, I mean, there are parts of it that are sludge, but we still see technological advance, and we still see compassion exercise. We still see those things still happen. In a form, justice still occurs sometimes.
Yeah.
We still know them. We still can see them. They're not absent entirely.
Yeah, it's a mixed. But the thing is, it is now mixed. It is now always mixed.
Yeah, it's mixed. That's the crucial thing. So that it, and I love the liquid getting into this chalk, which some of our older listeners might remember. I think the crucial thing to say about sin too is that it's not simply just trespassing of rules or breaking. It's not just rule breaking, and that sins plural are different from sin as a state, and I think the Bible very richly puts that in relation to God. So sin can be rule breaking or law breaking, but it's the breaking the laws of God. It's about not loving God as he ought to be.
The pervasive effects of sin, I think, are seen in the multiplicity of words that the Bible uses and images about sin. So it's debt, it's trespassing, it's wandering away from the path, it's getting twisted, it's rebelling.
Slavery.
It's being desolated. It's, yeah, this, and because yeah. our experience of sin is that it hurts in so many different ways.
Yeah, that's one of the most poetic things. I mean, a book I've read by Cornelius Plantinga, it's called Not the Way It's Supposed to Be. Terrific book, which I'd recommend. He calls sin corruption of shalom, which is God's peace, in the sense that the world is not what it is supposed to be. It's the title of the book. And then he goes through the different ways in which sin is described in the Bible, in just the way you've talked. It's quite a poetic and evocative book. A very sad book, because it opens your eyes to the way in which sin has had this hold on human beings in such a diversity of ways.
I guess so that's finally coming back to my answer to, is it a sin to speak about sin? No, but let's speak about sin in the fullness of how the Bible speaks about sin. Let's not use wanting to go back to the word sin to bring back a narrow understanding of it.
So where do we get it wrong, or where do preachers get it wrong when we talk about sin?
Well, I think sometimes people say, let's talk about sin, and then they forget that it does have a side where it is about brokenness, or it does have social systemic side to it, and so on. So I think we need to give people that enriched view of the understanding of sin. And I think we are all guilty of picking up the bit that we want to emphasise, that we find more palatable, but we really need to talk about the fullness of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great gifts of the Bible is its literary diversity and the kind of way it comes at this in so many different ways. I mean, I think lovelessness is a great sort of depiction of sin. The fact that when Jesus talks about the two commands of being love of God and love of neighbour, then clearly lovelessness
is a summary there.
Also, the big debate in church history has been about whether pride or idolatry are the sort of primary sin. But I don't think you need to kind of choose one or the other. Both are kind of great depictions of sin, human arrogance in wanting to be God, and then human false worship.
Yeah, and I find that difficult too, where people want to narrow it down and say, what's their idol here, rather than actually we're going to understand sin more and be able to deal with our sin more if we understand how it operates in so many different ways.
Yeah, although the good thing about the idolatry thing, so Tim Keller in particular talks about sin as idolatry, Tim Keller from Redeemer Presbyterian in New York.
I like Tim Keller, by the way.
Well, yeah, I like
it's always him. Really worrying if I like a reformed person, they should be very concerned.
They should be very concerned. I hope you don't like me. But he talks about sin as idolatry. The great thing about it is it names it as a theological category, not just a moral one. And so that helps us to say, and also talks about our hearts and our worshipping hearts and the way in which it's the way in which we are oriented as beings. And so it has a kind of pastoral resonance, I think, or an anthropological resonance when he speaks in this way. But I wouldn't want to, as you, I wouldn't want to limit talk of sin to that particular biblical.
And one of the reasons I wouldn't want to limit it is some of the problems that come out, the questions that we've got. So should we move along to those?
We shall. Before we get into our next segment, I just want to let you know about a very exciting, very non-sinful event, which is going to be on...
Well, don't make that kind of promise, okay?
It's on April the 11th. It's at Paddington Anglican, and it's going to be a live version of the podcast to which you are all invited. Now, the details will be on our show notes. Just to remember, that's at April the 11th, save the date, at Paddington Anglican. We're going to be talking about the upcoming election.
So there will be sin. If we're talking about the election, okay. there will be sin.
The other thing is, of course, we'd love you to leave a review on your podcast app or iTunes. It'd be great to have you. A nice review, if you can muster it.
Yeah.
That would really help us get listened to.
Q&A, you ask us questions and we answer without the spin. We asked on both our Facebooks, but this went down really well on your Facebook.
People, it really did. People really
like
love sin on mine.
On yours. And we got a couple of questions that we thought we'd deal with because they're connected. One of them quite a few people asked, which was, are some sins worse than others or are all sins equal? And the other one I think someone asked was, does intent make a difference? So yes. Why do you think, let's come to the first question, yeah. Why do you think people are asking whether some sins are worse than others?
Well, because partly because we don't want to be one of the worst sinners, but also because it's natural for us to think in this way, this kind of calculating hierarchical way about sin. I mean, that's human justice does that. We put people in jail for life for some crimes and we give them a slap on the wrist and tell them to pay a fine for others. So we can see that the impact of different sins is different. We can see that some sins are impossible for us to shake, and we really hope those ones aren't that bad. So
there's some personal agony in the question you're saying.
I think so. I mean, I don't know if you detect that, but I think there's some of that, and also just is God's justice similar to ours? Because quite clearly, we put murderers away for life, and we put traffic people who speed, we give them a fine. Yet God seems to judge all equally, and that seems weird.
Does God judge all equally? Anyway, well, I wanted to say, we can get, let's come back to that. Yeah. I wanted to say, one of the things I think behind the question is something that I have heard said by evangelicals quite a lot, which is all sins are equal. And so, but then your experience is that that's not the case. So, and that's never been fleshed out. I just feel like it just gets put out there, all sins are equal. But what do people mean by it? And I think that's a very difficult conversation.
Yeah, and I think that's because there's a difference between sins, plural, and sin as it's big category and what it actually is. So I think sins are multifarious and many and different and small and large, and of course they're different. And you can see in the law of Moses, you can see that they're treated, the punishment.
Yeah, so God
sins
does treat them differently.
Very much different.
In the law of Moses.
How you
yeah.
come back from.
Murder is worse.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
So there's a great variety of
so
sins.
So all sins are equal, but some are more equal
than others. That's right.
To quote,
so well, when we think that way, and also that when we think that way, we, you know, that's sort of natural for us. But to understand sin in its relational sense as corrupting love of God and love of neighbour, then even, you know, a lie and a murder are both unloving acts. They share, they're of the same species, so they have the same, that they are, you know, a poodle and a Great Dane are both dogs,
so they don't,
but they're very different dogs.
Yeah, and I think that's perhaps what people aren't getting when they hear all sins are equal. They don't understand it's being talked about the nature of sin. Or I would say often, like, the ultimate consequence, like all sin, no matter how big or small or what particular one it is, once it's a sin, it disrupts the relationship with God. So it's not like some are going to do that and some aren't. So in that sense, they're equal. But in terms of the consequences right now, of course there's different consequences.
Yes. I think what helps me is that the idea of sin being sin helps me not to feel proud about a person who appears to be a great sinner. So the person in my church who's been imprisoned, or the person in my church who had been a prostituted person, or has had many affairs, or has been an alcoholic for a long time. I don't, because I, for whatever reason, didn't do those things, get to feel superior to them. I only get to say, well, there but for the grace of God, go I, to use the cliche,
yeah.
But I am a sinner in need of salvation as they are.
In fact,
my pride and self-deceit are great sins too.
Well, that's what I was about to say, because I think sometimes it's not that therefore we should say that all sins are equal, but that sometimes we are ignorant of the effects of particular sins. And so we tend to treat some sins as worse when other ones have very destructive effects. But either we're not noticing those effects as much, or they're effects that we are more comfortable with, and that's a very bad thing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we're kind of cool with a few lies or gossip or destructive backstabbing. Or
yes,
what's the word we're using now? It's not talking smack. It's
you're casting shade.
Casting shade over people.
Alex, our producer, was bringing this up. He's younger.
Good to have a young
Let's
person.
Let's not say how much younger.
Yeah.
I mean... But also I think, like, say, for instance, leadership, that we're comfortable with our leaders doing some wrong things because we kind of think that's part and parcel with getting things done.
It's also the horror of, we trust leaders and it's really inconvenient to hold them to account because it means we then don't have a leader. And that's a scary thing to contemplate. I think we give them a lead.
Well, for some people it's scary.
Well, no, I think in general we want direction and we can't do without human authority, and then when it's corrupted, it's always shocking and awful.
It's always a bit simple, isn't it? Because it's humans, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't deal with it.
No. On the contrary, so we overlook some sins, but then you're then tending towards the all sins are equal argument. You're saying this inequality of sins means we overlook and de-emphasize some. So perhaps our human way of thinking isn't right. Perhaps they are more equal, or they.
Or I don't know. Is it better to say all sins are really, really bad?
Don't do it. Yeah.
Don't use any excuse.
Now,
to
Paul
sort of...
in 1 Corinthians does say that sexual sin has a particular resonance. He says, when you sin ordinarily, it's outside the body, but a sexual sin has a particular impact.
But he is there talking about. He is talking to a situation where there was sexual sin, so he's making a point that perhaps in other points he would say, this is why this particular sin is bad. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I guess, although, I mean, it's a human community, there's sexual sin. It's kind of given. I think it holds true in other places. I think we need to say it's not... It does have a particular impact on the person.
And also I would say with that, and I think me too... which I didn't mean to bring up so much in this episode, but I think that shows us that, in fact, we're not as strong on sexual sin as we think we are, because we don't like it when it's obvious and overt and we can't ignore it. But, in fact, it's been going on in our communities forever, and sexual harassment and that kind of thing is winked at.
Yes,
amongst Christians.
It certainly is. I mean, terrible, terrible bad behaviour. Mostly heterosexual terrible bad behaviour is overlooked, and we're kind of, because of the culture war issue, we're focused on that.
And when we say heterosexual, I would want to say that kind of bad behaviour by men.
Towards
women.
Okay, and I'll cop to that. Certainly, I think we overlook that. But I'd also say we give the heterosexual couple a leave pass and for whatever, and we don't hold them to account on that, and then we kind of, because we're so focused on talking about homosexuality.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So even within that, the way that we talk about it, we give more license to the things that we're more comfortable with. Talking about sexuality, because I think that brings us into the second part of this question about intent, because that comes into when Jesus said, you know, the same thing is happening when you lust in your heart as when you're actually following it through.
Yeah, so we're asking, does intent make a difference here? And it is interesting that Jesus is striking in the Sermon on the Mount how he addresses the heart, and that you, person who hasn't actually committed adultery or hasn't actually stolen something, you often it's very much just because you didn't have the opportunity, but you have done it. And to recognise that's really quite incisive. You know, it's really, you know, You haven't had a chance to think you'd get away with it. And, you know, actually, when we think we can get away with things, you find that lots of people steal.
Thinking that you won't get away with something does help hold you back. What gets me about that, though, is the problem is that if we don't make a distinction between intent and the action, which in the law we obviously we do, then what is to stop you once you've had the intent of going, well, I might as well just follow through in the action here? Because, you know, it's the same anyway. Like, I think that's a problem.
Yeah, and I would want to, of course, I think you have to kind of read Jesus then, not without taking him seriously, absolutely seriously, but you then say, yeah, don't contemplate adultery and then think, well, I'm done, so I might as well
in
go
for
away.
A penny, in for
no,
a
no,
pound.
Because
yeah.
I think there is a difference between intent and action, absolutely, and the action, the carried through action has more human consequences than just the contemplated one. It's just the spiritual state of the heart. He's just trying to say to us, your heart's no better. Don't get proud.
There's still a consequences if you're having an internal sin. It's not free of consequences.
No, you're just being a Pharisee. He's saying, look, like if you think that because you didn't carry it out, you're somehow better than that person.
And when we look at the Old Testament, there's voluntary and involuntary sin. Involuntary sin is seen as lesser, but it's still a sin.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been thinking about this lately. There are things I know I've said, and I look back at them and I think that was a really dumb thing to say. Or it's a really stupid and careless and thoughtless thing to say or to do. And I look back and I think, well, I was a younger person. I didn't know any better. But I can't excuse myself. I can explain. I didn't intend harm because I never intend harm. But but mostly. But I'm still somehow responsible and culpable.
Because things like neglect is a sin.
Well, we might say negligence
or
as well.
Or there's sins of omission where we fail to do the good.
Yeah. Yes. Is that different? That might be.
I don't know if it's completely different because I think some thoughtlessness is a failure to think, and thinking in that kind of way is a type of love.
Yes.
It's loving the other person enough to actually exert effort and time to think through what are the consequences of what I'm about to do.
Yes. Yeah. Although I sometimes look back and I think I could not have done differently just because of my character and because of what I knew at the time. But even then. I was negligent. I should have taught myself better. I should have, in order to prevent that particular instance, I could have taken steps towards preventing that. We're a mix of these kind of thoughts, aren't we? Like you think about how addiction works and how you've got the addict might sit down and say, I rationally can understand how I must give up, but then cannot at the same time. And so we understand them to be sick, but it's more than just sickness, isn't it? It's somehow a corruption of the will of the person's self.
And
at a very
you can't.
Deep,
it's very hard sometimes to sort of draw out the different threads of here's this bit, but perhaps I wasn't as culpable because of the circumstances going in, but that doesn't mean that there's no culpability. Sometimes you can't make a clear. Unfortunately, we're not doing that all the time. God's doing that. God's working out exactly how much.
Yes.
And then, fortunately, dealing with it.
So what about guilt? Is sin should you feel, do we feel guilty? I mean, what's the sort of, how we just sit with our sins? And I guess one question that people have asked a lot is, how is it, since we're saved and made new, that Christians still sin? I mean, is the Spirit of God not effective? Do we actually change?
I think part of that, you know, we were talking about before about the pervasiveness of sin and just how many effects it has. Sometimes I think we're a bit foolish in thinking that we can get over that quickly. So there's all the things that make us up, they start before birth. And then we're in a situation in which we're swimming in sin. So to kind of think that's going to be an
easy... This is a cheery thought.
It is.
So to think this is going to be easy, an easy triumph is...
Yeah, and that, I don't think there's anything in the Bible that says it's going to be easy.
But I don't want to sin anymore. I mean, I can't... I want to overcome. I want to change. I want to grow.
This is Paul saying, I do not do what I want to do. I actually had a moment with my eldest when he was a toddler, and he was pretending to be a superhero, and he had a tea towel because this is the level I put into their make-believe, being his cape, and then he'd been really nasty to him.
Dishwashing man. Go on.
I would like that superhero. Can we meet that superhero? And then he kind of was did something to his brother, and then I found him, and he'd taken off the tea towel and he'd thrown it away, and he'd put himself in time out. He was the kind of kid that put himself in time out.
Right.
And then I sat down with him, and he basically said that in a 3-year-old's way of why I don't want to sin, but I still am. And he was almost saying, therefore, I can't be the hero. I don't deserve the tea towel, the tea towel of heroism. And then I talked to him about, that all of us are in that place, but that doesn't mean that we can't do good.
No, and by the grace of God, that's exactly right. But also, I think one of the paradoxes of being a Christian is a deeper sense of this.
Mm.
And I've spoken to Christians who are kind of overwhelmed. Like they're thinking, I can't endure this sense of the complexity and how guilty I am, how immersed in this. I've understood that now. I just need to give it away because I can't cope. But we need to know even more the contrast between what we are and what grace is. And pastors need to be.
I think I found that as I've grown as a person, as a Christian, that I become more and more conscious of my sin, but I also become more and more conscious of grace. And those two things, those two aspects of growth have to happen at the same time. Otherwise, we're unbalanced and we cannot do good.
Yes. So feeling bad, or awareness of sin, is part of the Christian life,
mm.
but you wouldn't want to stay in that.
Mm-hmm.
And we need each other, and we need... We need the goodness of God, grace and mercy of God, to kind of chart our way out and through, and also the hope that the hope that we are going to be transformed into the likeness of Christ. No, absolutely. Mark and Dave, reviews from two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. Look, this is really out there for us, I think, for both of us.
This is kind of like discomfort zone for both of us.
That's true. And someone I work with said, this Kendrick Lamar, the hip-hop star from the United States, won a Pulitzer Prize for his album that came out in 2017 called Damn.
And we should sort of say, here again, we're listening to something where there's explicit lyrics. We do actually listen to stuff without that, but in this case, yes.
There's lots of explicit lyrics and unpleasant themes, shall I say, in Kendrick Lamar. But with Kendrick Lamar, the really interesting thing is, and he's not alone in this, is that he's overtly theological, calls himself a Christian, speaks about being converted in a way, and that permeates this album. It's called Damn, and it's got lots of songs with titles that evoke Christian or theological themes. It's got reference to Bible verses and particularly sin. So that's why we thought this episode would be a good partner
for it.
So he's
got pride and lust, and the other side of the coin, he's got songs called Humble and Love.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I think I've got to say, and I think we both should say, this is like entering into a world in which we don't, we're really real foreigners and amateurs. Like I feel like reading the lyrics and listening to it, there's a context, a world that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, there's a language, and so you kind of have to understand that we're not speakers of this language.
No, that's right. There are references and allusions clearly that I'm not getting, and I don't have a background of listening
and
to this
sort of
stuff.
And I couldn't parse the music very well. It's not the kind of music I listen to, so I was probably missing a whole lot of that.
But with all those caveats in place,
yes.
What's really interesting is I think one of the key songs here is a song called Fear, because Kendrick Lamar, he's explicitly saying that we should fear God, that you can't just stop at grace and isn't that nice. He's actually saying, no, actually there's a fearsomeness to God, and it's almost a sense in which he's saying, I'm now not comfortable. There's a discomfort in living in God's presence with God's holiness.
I've had a response to him from an article that someone wrote where he said, yes, you've picked up on what I was trying to do, that I think a lot of Christians, when they produce music or so on, want to go on about God's love. And he was like, no. I want to inculcate fear of God. That was,
yes.
That was his intent.
And what a disturbing thing to do, like a shocking thing to do. And he does this, of course, by social commentary, but also just in very autobiographical lyrics about his own life, the suffering of his own life. Sometimes it seems it seems shocking that he's sort of indulging in it. But again, with hip hop music, there's a lot of taking on voice, and so I can't always tell when it's irony or when he's in character.
Well, one of those that I picked up was the one called God.
Yeah.
And I had a particular read of that, and I didn't think, when I looked up what people thought on the internet, people had different reads. I'm still going with mine.
That's surprising.
Because I know what his intent was, yeah. But he's talking about that way particularly young male rappers like himself see themselves as God, that they're kind of wanting to be gods.
Yeah, this is what God feel like, laughing to the bank.
Yeah. And
it's a divine, powerful feeling.
Yeah, and then it turns around, and I think it turns around and it's actually God speaking to him.
Uh-huh.
In that...
You can hear me just... I've got my paper.
Okay, good.
Version of the lyrics here. You can no doubt hear them at the end. I mean, I can't read them out all the time because they're too rude. but yeah, I think he sends... You're saying God speaks to him at the end. This is what God feels like, laughing to the bank. But... what?
You got the lyrics.
I can't see what you're saying about though.
Really? He's saying that. So, for instance, it says, "I done put blood on sword. Everything I do is to embrace you all."
Aha. Uh-huh.
"Everything I write is a damn eight ball. Everything I touch is a damn gold mine. Everything I say is from an angel."
Uh-huh.
Now, it could be him saying, "Hey, compared to you guys, I really am the God, me, Kendrick."
Yeah.
But I actually think it's kind of a bit like Job, and God saying, "I'm God."
And he's kind of
I'm God.
No.
I'm the one with the magic eight ball because I can prophesy. I'm the one who died for you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just hard to see past that. Your hope is playing with that kind of trope in hip-hop music where it's, you know, I'm better than you.
Well, he does mention, I think he is. That's what I think's happening. And I think, because he mentions Job in one of the other songs.
Yeah.
So I think he's this clear allusion
really
to Job through this.
He really does this of, why am I suffering? That's in one of these songs here, which I'm just turning over to. I had fear, of course. I've mentioned that one. It's the song Humble. You know, why do I suffer? No one prays for me. You know, I just, you know, what's going on in the world for me? It's a sort of sense of then who's going to take care? Why is this going so bad?
What I particularly liked about this is when you're talking about social individual sin, I think Kendrick just brings all of that into this. He does talk about the election with Trump.
He does.
He does talk about his own experience as a black man, and that makes him a really important voice on this. But he doesn't in that way not acknowledge his own individual responsibility as well and his own individual temptations. So this is actually someone sort of wrestling with how those things intersect.
And, I mean, the complexity of it for me, though, is that, like, it's sort of mixed in with kind of allusions to what is pretty close, must be close to rape, and really strong imagery to do with women and violence.
And I do think, there's a major problem with misogyny in rap, and I'm not sure that Kendrick Lamar has properly dealt with that. Apparently, he has been interviewed about it, and he has acknowledged that it's a problem in rap and that in his own stuff and trying to work that through. So,
work that through. I mean, it's kind of so blatant. You know?
I think some of it, though, is some of, like, I was trying to read that carefully, and some of it, as you say, is some of the language and the tropes that they have. But I still think that they should go, okay, yeah, but is there an underlying misogyny even in that the language, the real language?
Yeah, and I find that sort of really hard. And again, I'm an outsider. I'm not from the African-American experience and all that. But I remember when I was a teacher, this is years ago, and the kids loved Eminem, right?
Mm.
Similarly sort of complex lyrics, very clever. But you've got these white kids in Australia listening to this stuff, and they don't have big irony filters. So if it is ironic and it's his in character, then they're not doing that. They're not kind of doing that sort of literary appreciation of what's going on. They're just hearing something really,
really,
I think really confronting.
Something, you know, that we need to talk to kids about and ourselves. And, yeah, music isn't neutral in that way. But I think why it won the Pulitzer is because it's kind of like a cry from someone who's acknowledging the struggle, is in the middle of the struggle. He's not necessarily resolved in everything in this. It really is. Like, I just found this, my heart was broken apart reading these lyrics.
Yeah, so there's that kind of bleeding honesty
written
right over it.
Yeah.
With All Due Respect is hosted by Michael Jensen and Megan Paldetois. This episode was produced by Alex Bennett and Bella Ann Sanchez, sound designed by Adam Jones. You can subscribe to With All Due Respect on iTunes, Spotify, or any of the other places you get your podcasts. And you can help us out by rating and reviewing the show on iTunes. That really helps other people find out about us. Check out our show notes if you want to take a closer look at anything we mentioned on today's podcast. You can even listen to Kendrick Lamar through that link, and you can find those at eternitynews.com.au/respect. And you can be part of the Respectful Conversation on the Eternity News Facebook page. See you next time.